Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Bonjour, this is Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. We are proudly part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. If you're looking for other fabulous shows on subjects like history, news, or pop culture, then check them out at evergreenpodcast.com. Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast, is the podcast that's all about the cuisine that is said to have founded modern cooking. French ingredients and dishes have been the starting block for many of the world's best chefs and cooks. On Fabulously Delicious, you'll learn all about those dishes and ingredients, as well as get to know more about fabulous French foodies. I'm your host, Andrew Pryor. Enchanté.
Enchanté.
10 years ago, my life changed when I competed on MasterChef Australia, and now I'm living my best life right here in the French countryside. Here, life is all about cooking, eating, meeting wonderful food producers, chefs, home cooks, drinking amazing wines, eating some of the over, would you believe, 1,500 French cheeses. Yum. And sharing these fabulous experiences with you, my fabulously delicious audience. I hope you're enjoying them. Today, it's International Chef Day, and so I thought we'd celebrate by bringing you the highlights from a great conversation that I had with a chef that has taken the baking world by storm. He's the host of the Great Canadian Bake Off, and a Frenchman who has found a life he loves in his new home, Canada. Sit back, turn the volume up. If you're not driving, pour yourself a glass of wine. Break a baguette, add a bit of saucisson maybe, some of that delicious cheese, and enjoy today's episode of Fabulously Delicious, a conversation with Bruno Feldenson. There's a lot to chat about today, but first up, I wanted to ask, you grew up in, pardon my French, Bruno, but I'm an Australian with a really bad accent. I will try and get it correctly. Clermont-Ferrand?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It's a great rugby town. Yeah, we have an amazing team. Not doing so well this year. And it's Michelin Tire's hometown.
Right, okay. It's near the Auvergne, is that right?
Yep. It's right in the center. It's been looked down by a lot of French people as the kind of the armpit of France. You know, we are looking, Parisians definitely look down on us like we are, rednecks. But it's okay, we love it.
I often hear about Parisians looking down on people, but I wonder, is there any real Parisians left anymore? I mean, you know, there's all these rules about how you can call yourself a Parisian.
I think it's a reflection of French society. You know, French society, it's a very elitist country. So if you make it to Paris, you're superior to anybody else.
There's obviously great food that has come from that region, the Auvergne. What dishes might we know from there?
I think we are known for sausage, like dry sausage, saucisson sec, cheese, you know, forme d'Ambert, Saint-Nectaire, yeah. And maybe for dishes, maybe une pâté auvergnat. So it's like a cabbage stew. So nothing sophisticated, but definitely great in winter months. Where I grew up, there is something called pompe au gratin, which is like a brioche dough, very dense, with pork rinds inside.
Sounds pretty good.
So not very rich in diversity in terms of cooking, but definitely very down-to-earth rustic food.
Your childhood wasn't exactly the idyllic French childhood, living in the countryside of France, etc. How did you end up then in the food industry? Was food really important to you as a child when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was, but I wasn't conscious of it. So yeah, food, I think food is important for every French. Anybody who lives in France, food is important. So it comes with, once you're born in France, food is important, like when you're born in Austria, ski is important. I think we don't realize it. So it wasn't a dream of mine to become a chef. My dream was to become a pilot. I wanted to fly planes all over the world. That was my childhood dream. But again, in France, being such an elitist country, you know, the schools are very selective. So I didn't do well in school, and they look at you down as, you know, you're not worth it. So we send you on the side to other school system. And you know, I was like, you know, I need to do something with my life. And then one day I was walking down a little town and I saw a chocolate shop that's been around for over 100 years who were looking for an apprenticeship. And I think I find, when I did the interview, the boss told me that he was driving Porsches and BMW. So I told myself, you know, maybe that's a job for me. But really, I fell in love with the smell and the scent of melted chocolates. That's how I started. I was like 15 years old, and I went for the interview with no plan, and that became the plan, you know.
Similar to myself, you had grandparents that were from Italy, but you had a grandmother that was there. Do you have many memories of her and her cooking?
Oh, yeah. We used to make gnocchis from scratch. And I remember making gnocchis with boiled potatoes, a little flour on the table, and one or two egg yolks. And, you know, we do by hands, and then we use a fork to roll it. And our tomato sauce wasn't like with fresh tomatoes. We will always do tomato sauce with tomato paste, water, olive oil, butter, and herbs and garlic. So it was a different, it was a very oily gnocchis with tomato flavor. You know, when I grew up, I don't think we had too many kind of tomatoes. We have, for what I remember, only one kind of tomatoes in the supermarket, you know, and that was to make tomato salad. You never make tomato sauce with it. That definitely not in France where I grew up. So tomato paste, maybe because it was the way to make tomato sauce for the poor people, I guess. But gnocchi, definitely, with my grandma, gnocchis. And we used to do, you know, she grew up in North Africa, so she will do a wonderful couscous. She will do escabeche, you know, those, you know, pickled sardines with olive oil and onions. And so that was my side of the Mediterranean cuisine at home. And, you know, keep in mind, I'm a first generation born in France. My family was German Italian. And then my grandfather was German born, you know, in Berlin. And his food was the total opposite for my grandmother. You know, it was black, dark bread with pork fat on the top. I don't think he knew what butter was. It was just pork fat everywhere. We will make cheesette. I remember going to the market to buy a pig's head. And then we will boil it for hours, shred the meat until you only have the bones, and chop it, put parsley, garlic, onions, and cook it in a ramekin to make a cheese head. So
fabulous.
But one thing my grandpa will eat at night late will be cold pasta with sugar.
With sugar?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he will go in the fridge, get the spaghettis like they were cold, put sugar or jam actually, and then he will eat it. And, you know, it's like starch and sugar technically.
You had grandparents that were Italian and German. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you really felt French?
No, I never. It's funny you say that because, you know, my family grew up, my grandma grew up in North Africa. She arrived in France because of the independence, and her first experience, and she was French born, she was French citizen, but she'd never been to France. And she told me when she arrived in Marseille with nothing, they have to leave in a hurry. A French woman went to see her at the railway station, spit in her face and told her, go back to your country. So I think it set the tone for my whole family that, you know, I think my grandma was never happy. I think she died miserable because she wasn't dying where she wanted to die. And you know, from that, I think I never felt I belonged. Plus you had the component of social background too. So yeah, I mean, my first reaction was, whenever I can get out, I get out. And lucky when I work in France, I have in our kitchen, we have a lot of young Americans working with us. Guy from Newport Beach, you know, and we're still friends 40 years later. Guy from New York, and they always tell me, you know, say, come to the US, you're going to love it. And there is nothing like someone who's cool from California. They take being cool to a level that we cannot achieve in France. And was this young kid from Newport Beach, Patrick Glennon. He was Irish-American from Newport Beach in California, a surfer, blonde, blue eyes, a fantastic cook. You know, he will kick ass. He will kick the French cook's ass in the kitchen, how good he was. And we became friends, and he kept telling me, say, Bruno, come over, you know, you're going to love it. And we became good friends, you know. No other French likes him because he was great and successful. And he never cooked. He only cooked in the kitchen because he needed money to surf in the south of France. That was his goal. And I find what means to work hard, to have a goal, and to enjoy life. I mean, the guy was a party guy, yet he was a fantastic cook. And royalty too, you know. 40 years later, we're still friends. The excellency we have in France is a product, the produce, the farmers, the small artisan. That's a strength for French cooking, I believe.
So your first job you mentioned before was in a chocolate shop. It was quite a prestigious one.
Yeah, you know, they were around for 100 years. And the equipment must have been 80 years old. I mean, everything was running with a big belt system. And the floor was just concrete and sawdust. Very old. And we will make everything from scratch. Praline, pralines, candied orange. So it was a very seasonal job. So in summer, we will do all the liquors. So, you know, with cornstarch in big chambers. I mean, you go home, you're like white. And then we will do the candied orange. We will get almonds whole. We will boil them to remove the skin, make marzipan with it. So it was I learned a lot. And in winter, we will do all the truffles for Christmas. And it was nonstop. I have a great boss. My maître d'apprentissage was a fantastic man. And he became almost like my first father figure around me, you know. Learned a lot, learned the principle, the basics, the respect. Not easy, you know, but actually it was a kitchen with very little bullying, which was good. But that was good for me. That established parameters, a strong platform, and good working skills, which helps you when you turn 20, 25, for sure.
And your apprenticeship was for 2 years, and you finished it with a kind of perfect exam, is that right?
I think I scored one of the highest score in the whole academy, all over France. It's called a certificate, so CAP, Certificate of Apprenticeship Professional, Certificate Apprentice Professional. And I think my score was 380 out of 400. I got the medal, I got the certificate. And
pretty amazing for a kid that's grown up in a foster system, you know, leave school at 15 to do that.
Yeah, it was easy. It wasn't, you know, sometimes it's hard. But yeah, I remember I cruised through it and my boss was elated because, of course, he make him look like an amazing instructor, which he was. But after, you know, the recognition as a boss, as a professional was huge for him. For me, it was just the first steps of with that. I mean, you know, he told me right away, you need to go to Paris. You cannot stay here. You have to go. The world is waiting for you. And I moved to Paris to work at, you know, a higher level of expertise, technique, like the way they do it was amazing, flavor-wise. I worked with an amazing, what was his name? Michel, I forgot his last name, but he was a chef, you know. Down to earth, very good at his technique. But unfortunately, I did experience a lot of bullying in that kitchen and sexual harassment as well. And so I decided to leave after a year and a half. And then a stroke of luck, one of our, we had somebody came to do a stage with us. And this guy was Frédéric Robert, and he was Alain Ducasse's pastry chef. Now, keep in mind, I have no idea who Ducasse was. And actually, at that point, Ducasse was still very... and we call him Dudu. You know, his nickname was Dudu. And Dudu was almost unknown. I think he only had a Star Michelin. He wasn't in Monaco yet. And then one day, Chef Ducasse called me and he's like, you know, Frederick spoke to me about you. He said, you're amazing. I want to hire you as a chocolatier for a new project. And I said, no, because I have no idea who he was. I'm like, no. And,
wow.
Because, you know, if you work in shops, it's a different world compared if you work in restaurants. Yeah. So I said, no. And then he called me again. He said, you know, Bruno, come. You know, I have this huge project in the Basque Country. You're going to love it. And I want to hire you as a chocolatier. I decided to go and say, yeah, you know what? Let's take a chance. And I go. And that was the jump into the restaurant world, the hotel world, I think, which is very important if you want to succeed. If you just stay in pastry shop, in stores, I think it limits your expertise. It limits the dynamism of what you can do. Restaurant is a different ballgame. It's a faster pace. It's nonstop. And you do meet a lot of great people from all over the world.
Do you want to support Fabulously Delicious, the podcast, and learn more about French food? Then join me and some of the wonderful people cooking it and producing it. Hit the subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts, be it Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. But is there one restaurant kitchen that you would have loved to have worked in? Or one chef that you would have loved to have worked for?
No, because I was loyal to Chef Ducasse. He was very good to me and I was good to him. And Ducasse was, you know, he has this, I don't know, this fatherly feeling. You know, when he speaks to you, you just melt because, you know, keep in mind, I met him after his plane crash. So I don't know if you remember the story. I think he was consulting for a restaurant in Courchevel. He took a plane back with his crew. A small plane crashed. He was the only survivor. And he has this, yeah. And, you know, and I met him right after the crash, maybe a year and a half, where he was walking around with canes. His hair was like looking on the side. And he was, you know, so anchored on the moment. I felt this guy is like, you know, he cares. I felt like he cared about his cooks. And only after I know the story that he was the only one to survive and he felt very guilty for a long time after. And, you know, I think Ducasse was for me like, you know, the guy who say, you know, you can do it. And he was always supportive. When I came to him, I said, Chef, I'm going to America. And he's like, sure, go. And if you're tired of it, call me and you come back with me. He never say anything else. He said, yeah, go. Go explore, go see. And yeah. That's what I like about him. I will go back to his kitchen.
You've just mentioned that you moved to America. How old were you when you went there?
23.
Okay, so still pretty young.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, naive as you can be. A backpack, no plan, very little money. You know, I have a friend who went the year before. He was a waiter. His name was Jesus. And Jesus went to LA and he kept, you know, no email of that type, nothing, but we will get postcards. He said, oh, guys, you have to come, we have to come. So a year later with a friend, I'm like, you know what? Let's get backpack and we go. And so first we flew to New York because I have some cooks we work with, in New York, and we stay in New York. And it was the typical New York experience when I arrived. You know, I was like, you know, no scared, fairly naive. And I just loved it, you know, just the way people walk, talk, eat. You know, I felt I belonged right away. I never felt as a foreigner, and it was a New York experience where for breakfast we go to a diner. And to that day, I still eat for breakfast the same when I go out, 2 eggs over easy with toast.
It's not very French of you.
Yeah, I know, but because that was my first breakfast in America with, what was his name? Patrick, I think. No. I forgot his name. And, you know, the elevator was the one operated with the cage and somebody was moving it up and down. I remember watching at 2 o'clock in the morning on public television. So I never seen cable in France because we didn't have, we have 5 channels. But in New York, you had cable. We have the cable box. And I remember watching Iron Chef from Japan at 2 o'clock in the morning on this local. Because in the US, there is like public cable, so you can buy your time and put whatever you want. So there is a wacky story, there is weird stuff, but there was the Iron Chef, the real one from Japan at 2 o'clock in the morning. I will watch it. I say, well, that, this is nuts. This is crazy. But that was 20 years before the Food Network, you know. And I love this eccentricity. We ate in a restaurant again, you know. We ate at a David Boulay restaurant. We had a Chanterelle. And we felt welcome, you know. And those were the restaurant of New York. That was the top of the top. Yet, as a young guy, I was feeling welcome. I was respected. I was never looked down that when you go to France, if you don't have the right jacket or a tie, you know, you cannot sit at that table. In New York, it's like, yeah, come spend money with us and have fun. And, you know, that was what I like. And I stayed in New York, not to work. We just enjoyed for 3 weeks. Then I moved to LA to see Rezus, my friend Rezus. And there was no Rezus at the airport. So we end up with my friend staying in Inglewood in a motel, you know, $25 a night. It was a weird experience, but again, I was naive. I was just, I think my eyes were like wide open.
Of course.
The new things. And then couldn't find a job, starting to run out of money. And then I found a job in a pizzeria downtown LA on Olive Street in the late 80s. Today is a bit better, but in the late 80s, that was scary. That was full of gangs. And after 5 p.m., there is nobody. It's just homeless and gangs on the street. So we work in that pizza and we live inside for a week because they have nowhere else to play, making pizza. The guy was an old Russian Jewish immigrant. And, you know, I wasn't scared. I was just, you know, this is cool. This is cool. You know, we're having a good time here. And then I met an amazing chef who really took me under his umbrella, and his name was Joachim Spichel, who, you know, who today run, I think he sold everything, but at that time he was the upcoming the chef from Spago was the, you know, upcoming chef in the US. And we opened a restaurant called Patina 25, 27 years ago. That was a place to go eat. He never became famous like Wolfgang Puck, but Joachim, I think today in LA, probably a quarter of the chef in LA went work for him at one point or another. And Joachim was like, he was the opposite of Ducasse. He was cold, distant, very hard to work with, but he was an excellent boss. Teach me how to embrace American culture. He told me, he said, if you're going to come here to cook French food, you're wasting your time, pack your bags, go back to France. But if you come here and embrace what people want, you're going to become very successful. And I worked with him in Carmel, Monterey, left and right. And he made me understood that in the US, there is culture. There is something called pop culture. There is some, you know, there is immigrants coming from all over the place. And he said, in your kitchen, you're going to have immigrants from Mexico, San Salvador. You know, those guys know how to cook. And he told me, remember, he said, those guys are the best cooks you're going to work with. And I'm like, how? You know, because again, I was conditioned as a French cook. You know, I thought the French were the hot shit. And then I work along Mexican cooks, and those guys are fantastic. You know, they've never been to cooking school, but they work hard. They know how to cook. They understand flavors. I always say, when you work in a kitchen full of, you know, Latin cooks, when somebody is starving, he's going to cook for everybody else around. If you work in a kitchen with just Americans, if he's starving, he's going to cook, he's going to make a sandwich for himself. So the dynamic is different, you know. The team spirit is different. And working in that kitchen in Los Angeles in the late 80s and 90s for me was eye-opening. That was the time I had my first mole sauce. You know, all those things are very complex. My first taco, my first burrito, my first, we used to go to El Pollo Loco to get charcoal grilled chicken with Mexican sauce. And it was so good, simple, but so good. And with Joachim, we learned to do stuff that people enjoy, to be different, to be, you know, we used to make a corn creme brulee.
Corn creme, yum.
Yeah, we used to make corn candy. We used to infuse a cream with popcorn, strain it, and that creme brulee was amazing.
You're listening to Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. Do you have a passion for one particular French dish, ingredient, or cooking technique? Add to that, do you have a story to tell? Well, I'd love to hear it, and I'm sure many of our Fabulously Delicious audience would too. So get in touch, slide into my DMs. I've always wanted to say that. On Instagram at Andrew Pryor Fabulously, as I'd love to hear from you and hopefully have you on Fabulously Delicious. Trying all this fabulous new food that you're getting influenced by there, the mole and things like that. Did you ever think of becoming a cuisine chef as opposed to a pastry chef?
So I did. So in France, I became a chocolatier with a diploma. But when I worked for Ducasse, on my day off, I would work in a fish station because that was the hardest station to learn in his restaurant. And you know, keep in mind, a fish station in France, you get your fish at 10 a.m. delivered. And you have an hour and a half to set up everything for your service starting at noon. So it was a fast pace. All the fish was amazing. I mean, nothing caught in the net, all line caught fish. Early in the morning, they will be delivered. I think probably still moving. So I learned that, you know, speed, organization, how to burn your fingers and move on, you know. And I always loved cooking. But when I moved to the States, I moved there with the idea I would become a chocolatier, but there was nobody making chocolates, actually. The only chocolate shop was Godiva. There was no chocolate artisan when I moved to the States, the way you have to. The bean to bar concept was non-existent. Hershey's, you know, people ask me, what do you work for? You know, Godiva, Hershey's? I said, no, I want to do... So it was not the concept. So I did pastry, but I always work on the side in the kitchen too. And I became a recognized pastry chef in the US, but often on my day off, you know, I will go work one day with Joachim in the kitchen because I love that rush, that crazy moment, that speed, that, you know, cooking and pastry is different world. I always say cooking is to feed an instant need. You cook because you're starving at the core. You have to survive, you're going to harvest, fish, hunt to feed yourself. Baking is different. Pastry is different. You do it for celebration, for pleasure, to share with people. So it's different approach, you know. Baking, pastry, it's planning, it's chemistry. Cooking, it's all at the last minute. It's all making something crazy. So I love the two aspects. But I did become more successful in baking and pastries than cooking in the States. And that time, everyone wanted a pastry chef. That was a time where pastry chefs were making more than restaurant chefs in LA.
Right. Okay.
I mean, you move to New York, you could ask for a six figure in early 90s as a pastry chef in a top restaurant. So there was that wave of, Food Network, pastry magazines. At that time, I think it was 20 of us, we were in high demand for pastry.
Fabulously Delicious is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Check out other shows at evergreenpodcast.com. If you're enjoying this episode of Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast, then you should check out my Story Of series, where we've talked about other fabulous chefs that have made history in one way or another in French food. I've discovered the father of French cooking, some would say, Marie-Antoine Conem. Auguste Escoffier, who set up the working processes that we know in today's commercial kitchens. Eugène Brasier, who many would say is the mother of French cooking. And another fabulous French woman who founded the acclaimed Le Cordon Bleu cooking school, Elisabeth Brassard. And many more fabulous chefs. To learn more about these fabulous French chefs and cooks and their stories, check them out at Fabulously Delicious, the French Food Podcast, and search The Story Of. You now live in Canada. Why did you move to Canada and when?
It was a strange circumstances. So I was living in New York, working with Four Seasons Hotel. And then I wanted to do something on my own. So an investor approached me out of Toronto. He said, I'm doing this new concept in Toronto. And now Toronto 25 years ago for food was maybe five big restaurants. And that's it. So he came to me and he loved what I was doing. He said, I'm opening this fancy pastry shop / restaurant / retail concept on Bloor Street. Bloor Street is like Les Champs-Élysées in Paris. Would you mind to come? And I'm like, sure. And we talk more. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, why not? So he will have me doing apply for a business visa. And so every 3 months, I have to renew that visa at the Canadian consulate. And sometimes it was difficult. And, you know, it was a bit difficult. And the lawyer from Canada said, oh, I will do your landed immigrants. And I'm like, I don't need it because I'm a U.S. At that time, I was already a U.S. citizen. And so never heard about it, but I did my stint in Toronto for 2 years. I would fly back and forth, Toronto, New York. And then we opened in Washington, D.C. So my circuit was Washington, D.C., Toronto, New York, because that was my home, Washington, D.C. So I was flying nonstop, 3 flights a week. Loved it, you know, making great money. And doing in Toronto something nobody's seen it, like a high concept French pastry restaurant. You know, I mean, nobody heard about Yuzu in Toronto in 98. We used to do stuff with Yuzu. Nobody knew what it was, you know. And so that was great. And then left the concept, opened my own place in San Francisco, a restaurant, because I always loved the northern coast of California. I've always been a big fan. You know, keep in mind, when I moved to the States after a few months, I moved and lived in Carmel, Monterey, which one of the most beautiful places on earth. Love it. It's like paradise. I still go back every 2-3 years. And I always loved San Francisco as a food town. Was just, you know, an amazing place. You know, you could see the synergy of the weather was like so unique. You know, it's cold in summer, warm in winter. You know, there is the daylight in San Francisco, because, you know, the way the sun moves, and it's a lot of white building in San Francisco. It's very bright, very, you know, and then around 2 p.m., this is a fog coming from the ocean, and the city becomes chilled and cold, and you're looking for a warm place. I love that dynamic. And so I opened a place in San Francisco, and I realized San Francisco was a tough city to cook. You know, it's a small town, San Francisco. It's probably the sixth largest city in California. It's not, you know, San Jose is bigger. Sacramento, I think, is a bit bigger now. And San Francisco, you know, it relies on tourism and convention. That's your bread and butter for a restaurant. And if they don't come, you don't do business. The local don't eat as much. You know, I opened in 2002. There was great restaurants in San Jose. Nobody would drive from San Jose to San Francisco. So it was a bit tough. I did get a great review with Michael Bauer, the food critic, from the Chronicle. You know, he gave me two and a half stars for my restaurant, and then the business like boomed, packed overnight. And, you know, and then it's not good to be busy overnight. It's never good for a restaurant. Couldn't manage properly, and then we get hit with back to back with the war in Iraq. So that year, no European went to San Francisco, very little, because there was this climate of the French didn't go with us. And, you know, and San Francisco, it's a very anti-war, peaceful city, but, you know, no, it was no tourism that year. And then we have the SARS issue too, you know, a lot of people canceled. Yeah. The business went belly up, and I have to drop out from the restaurant, close it, because I wasn't making money, you know. And San Francisco, it's tough for restaurants. In good time, it's difficult. So in bad time, it was a nightmare. And then that, within 3 months, I get in a mail, from the Canadian immigration, that I was accepted to move to Canada. That was like, yeah, pure coincidence. And I always loved Vancouver. You know, I would come to Vancouver often from San Francisco to our flight. And Vancouver at that time was still cheap. You could rent a condo in a waterfront for $600-$700 Canadian, which is not the case anymore. So I kind of have a little getaway home in Vancouver. Exchange rate was great, 2 hours flight. And then when I'm like, you know, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to take, you know, I deserve a break. So close my restaurant, sold all the equipment, what I can, and moved to Canada. And I'm like, life is good here, you know, life. And then I met my son's mom. She became pregnant. And I was supposed to move back to the States because I was Four Seasons Hotel wanted me to do a new project. And my GM from New York was part of that project in California, the new Four Seasons at Whiteless Village. But because medical insurance will not cover her for her pregnancy, I'm like, I cannot do it. You know, I'm staying in Canada. And this struggle a little because, you know, Canada is a different ball game, it's a different market. You don't get paid the same. I mean, now it's better, but in 2002, 2003, Vancouver, if you ask for $50,000 for a chef position, people look at you with eyes like this. It's not the same kind of, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, you know. It's very reserved, very, you know, they do copy a lot in Canada, I find, in terms of restaurant. It's better today, but, you know, you could go to Vancouver restaurant 20 years ago, and it was all spit copies of restaurants in LA and San Francisco. I won't give any names, but, you know, those guys went to San Francisco to learn. So, you know, you do have to learn one way or another. But
so then how did the opportunity come about to be a judge on the Great Canadian Bake Off?
So, you know, they won't tell you anything. So I got a call from CBC, which is, you know, the national network in Canada. It's like ABC in Australia. And they say, well, there is a show we want to do. Would you be interested? I'm like, what kind of show? We cannot tell you. And, you know, I'm like, no, maybe not. And they say, you know, could we do an interview with one of our casting agents? I say, maybe. So I do my first interview and I told her, I said, listen, I think there is better pastry chef out there for that job than me, you know? And that was it. Then a week later, they called me again. Say, Bruno, you know, we want to talk about you, to you. Would you fly to Toronto to meet us to do some technique on camera? I'm like, okay, I go, you know, we're good to lose. I spent a few days in Toronto, which is a city I love. So I fly to Toronto, bump into my best friend at the airport with a pastry chef who is being calling for the show too. I'm like, Thomas, what are you doing here? So I'm going to Toronto for what? Well, the CBC called me. I'm like, here we go. So we end up going to Toronto together, and then we know nothing much. So we are put in a hotel. Next day, we are driven to the studios to do the interview on camera, the whole chemistry, and the, you know. And they, I remember Thomas and I, we walk into the room. There is maybe 20 guys for the job. And I look at Thomas, and he look at me. I say, dude, what a fucking waste of time. They will never pick us. Because those guys in the room were like models, you know. It was an Australian guy, blue eyes, blonde, like straight from Bondi Beach in Australia. There is skinny jeans, tattoos, hipsters. I mean, you name it. And there is two average Joes, me and Thomas.
Bruno. Now, you're selling yourself short there. You've got that French accent. I mean, hello.
And Thomas is German, so we play a trick.
No, he's not getting in. He's not getting in, for sure.
So German. Thomas, I took a German accent when I did the stuff, and Thomas took the French accent. So we kind of play the, you know, so one of the casting director was confused because I show up and say, I'm Thomas. Nice to meet you, you know. And Thomas went, oh, my name is Bruno. So we closed it. But we did on camera testing, so we kind of fake the whole thing. They hire actors. And I, you know, I live in LA for 4 years and have friends who are actors. And I learned one thing in acting. If you try too hard, you're not yourself and they won't cast you. And everybody else was like, I look at them and I look on camera and they are like, they're not themselves. They're just, they pretend, they were acting, they were creating this mannerism. And me, I just go. But what we had a lot of recipes to taste. And those recipes had mistakes in them. And we have to kind of understand the problem and explain and doing it in a whole constructive way. So I remember it was this muffins who obviously was no eggs inside. So when I tried, they want to see reaction. And my reaction was like, you know, you want to critique without being critical. You want to, you know, explain that, that muffin is lacking texture, you know. Did you forget anything? Because I feel, you know, maybe you don't have the right amount of eggs, you know. I mean, look at the bounce. And then you explain. It's one thing to critique, but if you don't explain why. So I say, look, your muffin, you know, it's very dense. It's lacking that bounce back, that beautiful texture you would expect in a muffin. You can even see it the way it's rounded. You know, it wasn't created that, you know, and I think You know, the eggs, either you forgot or you didn't put enough, but there is an egg problem. And then what do you think? Try it yourself. You know, you create that connection. And I guess they love what they saw. So I think we did like 6 on camera technique. And next day they called me. I was still in my hotel. They said, would you mind to come back again today? So, and it was just me and Thomas. We are the last 2 guys. We did another whole day on camera. And Thomas told me, I don't want to do it because it's not me. It's not what I want to do. He said, Bruno, it's yours. I don't want to do it. And I told Thomas, you know, you're my best friend. If you get it, I'll be happy for you. I'll be thrilled. I said, don't say no because you owe me. I mean, I want you to fight for that job.
So you've been a judge now for 5 years on The Great Canadian Bake Off. Do you have a favorite contestant on the show, or can't you say that?
No, I don't have. I mean, I love them all, and I don't have any favorite one for the only reason that I trained very hard not to have any bias against any bakers. That my judgment is only based on the bakes and the baking, nothing else. If I have a favorite, that will infringe of my ability of judging. So actually we don't know who they are until the day before we start shooting. There is very little, we have no connection with them, and I won't even engage with them off set. So we're on set, we talk, but off camera, we don't have any, because you don't want to create, and I think human nature is to develop connection with people.
Yep.
And I don't want that to interfere with my ability to judge properly. So I can tell you, I do have a ton of respect for all of them because it's not easy. And I do tell them, you know, I mean, every season the same. Nobody wants to go home first. And it's the hardest one to judge too. And I always tell them, look at it, it's like a book. Chapter 1 is that important as chapter 8, 9, and 10. So, you know. But, you know, favorite desserts, what I tried, I mean, some of the stuff is fantastic. Baker, I think some are better than others. Of course, some are more talented. But at the end of the day, I can't because, and I never wanted, because they are all amazing. You know, I mean, to be there, to do what they do under a tent in summer in Toronto, we're talking about days when it's 40 degrees Celsius under the tent. And they do it. And, you know, there is no fake. If it's 2 hours, it's 2 hours. We don't do, let's do it again. Oh, sorry, you know. And all of them, I mean, there is very little failure. We do design the whole program to be sure they are set for success. You know, if you fail, because you fail, not because you're out of time. It's designed in a way that, you know, it's nurturing. You build, and they all come friends from day one, you know. I do go, like in Vancouver, one of the bakers organize every year Christmas dinner, so it's getting bigger and bigger. I do join them, you know, and they become friends for life. It's an amazing experience. I mean, keep in mind, there is nothing to win. There is no money prize. There is no, you know, it's a huge time commitment. So, you know, if you make it to the final, it's 7 weeks commitment and paid. And so respect for all of them, tremendous amount of respect. None of them are my favorite because, you know, I look down just at what I have to judge. I think super important, you don't judge based on ethnicity, where you come from, where you learn, your grandparents, where they come from, the color of your skin has no play for me, in my judgment. I think for other judges the same. We look at the bake. I can tell you, one of the best chocolate mousse I had in my life was on a set in season 4 from Rafi Katz.
Wow.
She made a chocolate mousse in the semifinal. That was probably the best chocolate mousse I had in my entire career, if not the best. And I want to remain that way, that, you know, I look at the skills, the product was presented, that's my criteria. I don't, because otherwise it's a circle you fall and it's very hard. And I think the other contestant we feel, if you have a favorite, I think people can catch it. People can see. People can, you know, because you can look at people do a little smirk, a little smile, and the other contestant will see it right away, you know, say, oh, you know, and that takes away from, it's not fair for anybody. So, you know, we say hi, we wave, but we don't have any interaction. And I think it's the best way to do it.
The host of that first season, which was Dan Levy, he is just a pioneer in what he does. You know, in Schitt's Creek, it was just an amazing television series. What was it like to spend that time working with him?
So to be on TV was never part of my big plan. To be on TV next to Dan was even a remote part of my big plan. So I watched, funny enough, the year before, I watched season one or two of Schitt's Creek. And then when I asked who's on the show with us, somebody said Dan Levy. But I didn't put two and two together until a few days before we met. I'm like, fuck. So I was like, I wouldn't say starstruck, but I'm like, this is big. I mean, I need to perform. So I put a lot of pressure on myself to perform, to, you know, and my frustration on season one was I was never trained to be on TV. I was thrown in, you know, so I get very frustrated because, you know, it's a long day, a shoot day. An episode is 2 days, 6:30 to in the morning to 8, 9 p.m. at night. And so to keep your energy level is very difficult. But season one, I felt I had the same narrative. I was repeating myself all the time. And Dan was good in a way, like he never made me felt I don't belong. He always made me felt I was part of the team. He was very nurturing. He said, don't worry, it's fine. It's okay. And those little moment was like, thank you. You know, that he would look at me, you know, because I will be, you know, I will be on set. You know, when we do the on a technical in sixth place, and you know, whose are those? So I had the line to say, whose are those? Now in French, we don't say that. We don't have that. And for me, season one, who is this? You know, and I remember people laughing on the back, and it kind of frustrated me. I know he wasn't, you know, it was cute, but I'm like, I don't want to be on TV seen as a cute guy. I want to be seen as a professional because Dan is putting his time, Dan is Dan's reputation as well. I want to be seen as a professional. So season one was struggling for me internally. Like I felt I didn't belong there. I felt I wasn't worth it. I felt even like, why did you choose me? I can't even pronounce, you know. But Dan was very supportive. Dan is a very busy man. I mean, keep in mind, Schitt's Creek, he act, produce, and write it. So he was doing, on season one and two, he was working on Schitt's Creek at the same time for the following season. So he has his own team, but still he made time to say, Bruno, thanks, you did great today. And I remember leaving feeling like not great, and just for him to say, you know, good job. And because he's a professional and he knows what he's doing. Julia was fantastic. She was so cool, down to earth. So season one, I struggled internally. I guess I did well because season two, I was called back. But season two, I came back prepared. I took lesson. There is a lot of technique you can learn. You know, when you're in front of a camera, you want to say everything right away. I learned technique like pause, breathe, capture the moment. And there is technique of space and time in front of a camera. And it's not easy, you know. So I learned this. I learned how to speak clearly, slower, articulate, create that narrative that capture people. So I did a lot of off-seasons training. And I remember one of the trainer told me, he said, Bruno, in the eyes of the viewers, you are the expert. So you have to speak clearly. You have to express properly. And then season two, I was better. And Dan saw it. Dan is like, dude, what happened during the break? I say, you know, I took lessons because I want to be worth it. I don't want to waste anybody's time, you know. Dan didn't come back on season three because I know season two, he was struggling between shooting Schitt's Creek. And I think he wanted his last season of Schitt's Creek to be the big boom. So he didn't come back. Julia had a big contract with a new show in the US. So he was timing. We moved some of the production, but they couldn't have them both on set at the same time. So they pick over host for season three. Again, it's always about timing, how to coordinate the schedule of four people on set. Keep in mind, one season is 8 weeks of shooting.
How can I have you on the podcast and not ask you about French pastry? Is choux pastry really a pastry or is it more of a paste?
Well, it becomes a pastry once you fill up with custard or, you know, but it's I mean, the sweet paste has very little sugar, like tiny amount. So, but it is used. I will say 90% is used in pastry, but you can make gougère with it, and it's the same recipe. You just put cheese. So, you know, it's looked, you know, it was probably developed by cooks to make gougère, and then pastry took it. I don't know the whole story, but the way I see it, you know, he was a cook trying pastry.
Short crust, pâté sucre, or puff pastry, ruff puff, are they French or are they from somewhere else?
So ruff puff is not French because the French will not allow it in the kitchen. You know, you need to learn that technique. So, but it's a good way to, it's a good shortcut because nobody has the technique or the time to make puff pastry. And, you know, let's face it, in a regular home, it's not easy to make. I don't do a pastry, puff pastry here because it's so difficult and frustrating. So it's a good way to make it. It's fast, it's short. And if you do it well, it's flaky, it's tasty, it's crispy. So I don't have any problem. Pâte brisée, pâte sucrée, you know, it's classic. Pie dough when you come to North America with lard and shortening. To make a good pie, you need a pie dough. You know, I've done pies with pâte sucrée, pâte sablée. It's not the same. A pie dough with a shortbread, you know, a short dough, it's better, I think. And I don't have, you know, I love butter, but I got to say a flaky dough with lard, it's nothing wrong with that, you know. But under the right circumstances, you know, there is a love of pies in North America. To respect it, you have to embrace it. You have, you know, one of my first cookbook I bought in the U.S. was an American baker by Jim Dodge. You know, a guy who was training Italian American, but an amazing pastry chef. And I bought his first cookbook. It's all about pies, crisp, cobblers. So that's, I never heard, but that technique of juicy pies, of, you know, the dough soaking into it. It's a whole different approach from French. It's simple, but not that easy to achieve, you know. And I learned a lot from that, of principle of baking, of dough, of, you know, I use butter 90% of the time, but a flaky pies, you need lard for it, you know. Yeah. And of course, I don't eat lard because, you know, I always say, you know, I only eat stuff I can put on my bread. If I can spread it on my bread, I eat it. Lard, I don't. But on a flaky dough, it works better, you know. You know.
That's it for another episode of Season 3 of Fabulously Delicious. Hope you've enjoyed this great conversation with Brino. What's the most fabulous thing you learned from today's episode? Let me know by contacting me via Instagram. Slide into my DMs at Andrew Pryor Fabulously, or email me on contact@andrewpryorfabulously.com. I love to chat with you all. Thank you for listening, and remember, you know what my motto is, whatever you do, do it fabulously. Merci beaucoup and bon app.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our 9th season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.